Welcome to the more comfortable super section. I'm Rob, and
I'm Walter,
and we're here to go over some more comfortable material. If you are less comfortable in between, that's totally fine. Hopefully you see stuff today that still helps you. So first thing I'm gonna go over is some terminal stuff. If you were in the prior less comfortable super section, they went over some terminal stuff. So this will hopefully go over a bit more than that super section did. There will be some repeats. So first thing first, here we have our terminal. We've seen a couple of commands so far, but I'll go over them again. But just to give a name to this, this program that is actively running that I can type commands into, I'm gonna call this bash. So bash, alternatively, I might call it my shell. It's literally just a program that, like programs you're going to be writing, waits for me to type things in at standard in and then prints stuff out for me and runs various programs. So this program is ultimately no more special than the programs you'll be writing. Okay, so first thing is we saw the, an easy command is just touch. So touch, I'm gonna be using just to create a bunch of files throughout this. You'll pretty much never use this program, but it's easy to use for examples in this case. So if I touch ABC, we'll see along the side that I just created three files called ABC. And so now one of the fundamental commands that you actually will be using a ton throughout the course is ls. So ls lists the contents of the current directory. Now there are flags to basically all commands you can possibly think of. There are flags you can pass to have them to alter their behavior. So for example, if I do ls-l, this dash -l is a flag I'm passing to the ls program that says list more information about each file. So ls-l gives me this information where we see that file A was created on September 7th at 2038. It is owned by the Ubuntu user, and these are permission bits that you'll see later, but ultimately this is just all of the metadata about the files. So another useful flag for ls is ls-a. So notice that I see here, when I just type ls, I see abc as my files. If I touch, or if I do ls-a, I now see these extra files, dot, 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 and dot c9. So what does dot mean? Yeah, current directory. So this is what you saw in lecture that basically whenever you wanted to run a program, we said something like dot slash hello to say in the current directory, run the hello program. And so what does dot dot mean? Yeah, the previous directory. So if I, let's mute that. If I now, just to throw another program that you've seen in the lecture so far, cd, change directory. So if I change directory, dot, dot, notice I've gone from workspace up one directory into my home directory. And so if I go back into workspace, what happens if I do cd, dot? Nothing happens because I literally just changed into the current directory, so the directory I was already in. So I could do cd, dot, slash, dot, slash, dot, slash, dot, and it just goes into the current directory over and over again, and it doesn't actually accomplish anything. So I could also do something like cd dot dot to go up one directory and then go back into workspace, up one directory, back into workspace. Ultimately, I'm not accomplishing anything, but it just goes to show that you can follow these chains of directories easily. Okay, so now a couple of useful commands. Well, let's make some directories first. So the command to make a directory is, I'll just zoom. The command to make a directory is mkdir, so make dir, make directory. Now, a lot of these commands you can ultimately accomplish by doing stuff up here with like creating new files, creating new directory, new file, new folder. So you could do that, but ultimately all of this you can accomplish at the command line. So instead of hitting new folder, I can do make dir foo. And so we see that we just created a directory called foo. You can also see that if I do ls, I now have the three files abc, and I have the foo directory. Okay, and I get cd into foo, I can make another directory bar, cd into that, make another directory baz, and cd into that. So now some useful cd commands. Let's say I go up three directories, and now I'm in workspace again. So cd dash is basically a toggle between the previous directory and the current directory that I'm in. So if I do cd dash, I see that I've gone back into the baz directory because that was the last directory that I happened to be in. And now if I do cd dash again, where am I going to go? I'm going to go back to workspace because that happens to be the previous directory I was in. So cd dash is just going to go back and forth between the workspace and baz directories at this point. So if you wanted to make a directory and cd into it in the same line, there I could do something like this. So make dir foo2 and cd foo2, which doesn't actually accomplish anything. That's basically like, yeah. So there isn't really a way to make it and cd into it. Basically, one of the founding principles of bash, of Unix, of Linux in general, is that every function should do one thing, and then you can compose functions to accomplish more. So like, it would be superfluous for us to have a make dir command that also changes into that directory when we already have a separate change directory command. Okay, so now that we have a make directory command, the equivalent removing a directory is rmdir. So I can rmdir foo2, and notice up here that when I do that, foo2 is gone. So now what happens if I do rmdir foo? I get fail to remove foo, directory not empty. So the flaw with rmdir is that it can only remove an empty directory, which is pretty inconvenient, because like, I could go all the way in. All right, now remove baz. Now go up one, remove bar, go up one. Now that foo is empty, I can actually remove foo. But that takes forever, and no one's going to take that time. Yeah?
Are these commands posted somewhere on the CS50 website?
So, they can be. We'll append them to the, or prepend them to the PowerPoint for this super section, and that'll be posted online. But ultimately, these are like fundamental bash commands and Unix commands that you can just look up.
Yeah, there are a lot of these commands that exist. We don't remember most of them. The most important thing is that you remember, oh, there's a command to remove a directory that's empty, and then you just look that up.
Yeah, so part of this is like, I'm going to throw a whole bunch of stuff at you, and I don't expect it all to stick, but the idea is like, you sort of remember that these things exist, and then when you happen to want to use them, you're like, oh, I remember that this exists, and you go look it up. Yeah?
What was the point of the dash A file?
So, I can go more into that. So ls-a shows all of the contents of this directory where, notice if I do, so touch, remember touch creates a file. So touch.abc. So if I ls, I don't see that file. And notice up here that I don't see that file here. So basically within bash, within Unix, it's a convention that files that start with a dot are hidden. And so ls-a explicitly says that I want to view all files, including the hidden ones. So now if I do ls-a, I see this .abc file as well as a .c9 file. In fact, if I go up one directory, like out of my workspace, and I do ls, I'll see bin, lib, sessions, workspace. If I now do ls-a, I see a ton of stuff. So it's very common for programs to store configuration files as .dot files inside of your home directory. Questions about that? Okay. So going back, let's just as another flag, so I can do a bunch at once. So instead of needing to make dir foo, then go into it, make dir bar, go into it, make dir baz, dash p, you'll almost never use this, but dash p just lets me make multiple nested directories. So that just created the foo directory, inside of which has a bar directory, inside of which has a baz directory. So go all the way in there. We already saw cd dash is going to toggle. Another useful one is that this tilde always refers to your home directory. So we see that over here. And so I can cd into tilde, or I can go back here, I can cd into tilde workspace. An even more convenient way, there's no reason to ever say cd tilde, because cd, in this case, it's probably going to do something different, but hold on. So cd will automatically bring me back into my home directory, except for in Cloud 9, we generally consider workspace to be your home directory. So we've hard-coded cd to just automatically go back to workspace. So if you ever want to go back to workspace, just cd, and it'll automatically go there. OK, so two more things just to point out that you should be aware of is that the terminal has tab completion. So it's, let's say I make some ridiculous blah, blah, blah directory name. It's the most painful thing when someone has a like a directory at office hours or a file at office hours, and they're going cd s-u-p-e-r-c, like at this point, and I even typoed, at this point just hit tab, and it'll complete it for you. And so that's an easy way that when I want to cd into foo, now I can hit tab again. It'll automatically complete bar, because that's the only directory that happens to be in foo, autocomplete baz. And it's an easy way of traversing directories. Another thing is that you can go to previous commands with up and down. So some people, you'll see that they'll type like make Mario over and over and over again when all they have to do is like up enter. Okay, questions about any of that? Okay, so another useful bash thing is you'll see every once in a while this star, and the star is basically a wildcard. So let's, as an example, let's touch some files. So touch, I don't know, hello one, hello two, dog hello, and just hello. So now I have these four files in this directory. Now if I wanted to list all files that started with an H, I could say lsh star, and the star is a wildcard that'll just fill in with any possible characters. So here it lists hello, hello one, and hello two, because dog hello doesn't start with an H. I could also do ls star one to list all files that end in a one, so the wildcard can go on the left side. I could do ls star underscore star to list all files that have an underscore within it. So dog hello is the only one that happens to have an underscore. This is sometimes useful if you have a directory with a bunch of files, and let's say foo.c, blah.c, blah.h. So if I wanted to list all c files in this directory, I could say ls star.c, and those are all the c files. And ls star.h, and those are all the .h files. Questions about that? Yeah.
So, I don't know, just minor correction, but I feel like what you're actually doing when you type ls wildcard is you're telling ls to list the contents of any files that match the wildcard. So that, for instance, if you do ls star, if you have any subdirectories, it will list the contents of those directories instead of just showing you the files.
So if I have ls star, it'll list the contents of any subdirectories. So. But I don't know the question yet. I don't understand the question yet. So give me an example.
What I'm trying to say in a respectful way is that don't use ls star, star something.
I use ls star all the time.
Yeah, it just happens to work because you don't have subdirectories at this moment.
But if I, okay, so give me an example with a subdirectory.
For instance, if you do echo star on h, watch it do exactly the same thing.
Okay, so blah.h. So, yes. Well, okay, so what he's saying is that what star is doing is expanding within bash. So basically what I'm running is when I do ls star.c, bash is automatically expanding this to ls blah.c, hello.c, alphabetically, bar.c, and then that will actually list those files. So
one of those being a directory, and what ls is going to do is
okay. This is getting very nitpicky that, like, if I created a directory called blah.c, or...
Okay. Are you already into a folder?
Okay, I'm in foo.
Just touch A, B, C, D, F, G.
Touch a single file or a bunch of files?
Multiple files.
A, B, C, D, E. Okay.
And then CD dot dot out of foo.
CD dot dot.
LS star.
LS star. Okay.
Not what you want.
I don't know if I would claim this isn't what I want. Like, this goes, I wanted to list all files, and I guess it's debatable whether this is what I wanted, but this is generally what I want.
Okay, then generally, if I have a giant tree of files, then if I would do ls star, it's going to print me the whole tree.
Oh, yes. So that would be, if I did, like, if I went into here and did ls star, it's going to give me a whole bunch of stuff. So that's why I very rarely do ls star. I much more frequently do like the ls star.c, just to get specifically the files that end in .c. If I wanted, I could get more complicated and do like find dot dash name star.c, and that would explicitly look for the files, and I could specify whether I want to recursively or not, but ls star.c is an easy way for in CS50 for you to get the list of .c files in this directory.
Echo
dash 1.c. Echo, okay, but like intuitively, echo dash 1.c, or echo, yeah. Echo star.c is another thing you could do. Which one do you find more intuitive, echo star.c or ls star.c? The gist is like there are multiple ways you can accomplish these things. And if you happen to remember list or ls lists the contents of a directory, then ls star.c lists the .c files in the directory. It's like a very semantic way, even if it doesn't always 100% do what you want, as long as you recognize the situation where things go wrong and then you go, okay, let me go Google for how the find command should actually work.
I promise you won't always get everything you do exactly right. That's okay, as long as you can then correct that.
Yeah. So I use ls star.c all the time, and I find it much simpler than needing to type out a full find command. It's like several characters fewer than typing out a full find command. Okay, so another little bash syntax trick that you'll very rarely use in this course, but just to throw it out there because I never saw it until like years after I should have, is so before when I was creating files, I did, let's just start over. Well, we'll go over that in a second. But when I was creating files, I did like touch, hello one, hello two, hello three. So a very useful bash syntax is to say something like touch hello curly brace 456. And so what this is going to do is ultimately going to expand that this was basically the same as typing touch hello 4, hello 5, hello 6. So a scenario where I happen to use this a lot is when running check 50. Sometimes for check 50, you want to pass both a .c file and a .h file. Not in this particular problem set, but imagine you had both a mario.c and a mario.h. I might do check 50 2016. I don't remember.
All p sets, whatever.
I don't remember, but let's say 2016.mario and then mario.c, h. And that would expand to mario.c, mario.h. Yeah.
Oh.
Let's unfull screen. And
perfect, thank you. Or just a bit more. There we go.
All right, I might have to drag and whatever. Okay. So So for pset 1, there isn't a mario.h. But let's talk about, say, cs50.h. So you've been hash including cs50.h in a lot of your programs. And so what the .h file contains is a and you haven't even talked about function prototypes yet, but it contains a list of function prototypes, and my mom tagged me in a photo. A list of function prototypes and like you remember, or even standard io.h, that whenever you forgot to include that, it would complain if you tried to use printf, because it's like, I don't know what printf is. Yeah. So standard io.h contains a description of what printf is so that your program knows how to use it. And so the .c file, so like there is some standard io.c out there, that contains the actual implementation of printf. So the .h just describes how to use it. The .c is the actual implementation. And so for later problem sets, you will have both a .c and a .h. But in this case, Mario is a simple program that you don't need a .h file that describes how to use it. So the difference between hello.c and the hello executable. So let's start with a very basic example. Let's just create a hello.c. So new file. I'll save it as hello.c. Okay, so hash include standard.h int main void. You've seen this multiple times at this point, but it's exactly the same as the hello world solution that's in the pset. Okay, so here's your basic hello world. So now if I do ls amongst all my other hello files, I have my hello.c. So now if I type make hello, I see that I have both a hello executable and hello.c. And if I do ls-l, I'll see that hello.c is just 69 bytes. Hello, the executable, is 9,600 bytes. And so this is the compiled version of things. If I try to open this file, it's a bunch of garbage. So ultimately what this garbage is the actual binary that the computer reads in order to execute the program. So a computer cannot directly execute a C file like this. You need to compile it into the binary that it actually understands. And at the end of this, we'll go over the actual compilation steps. David vaguely touched on it at the end of the last lecture. Okay, so a couple more that you might find useful. First, this one you probably won't find useful, but let's remove all these. Okay, when I say rm star, it's gonna tell me, do you want to remove regular file hello? Yes. Do you want to remove hello.c? Yes. Hello one, yes. Okay, so that's annoying. If I just do rm-f star, and you have to be very careful with this sort of thing, but rm-f star is going to force the removal and not question me about it. So it'll just remove them without that prompt.
By the way, you'll notice that he used control C to stop that rm from continuing. Control C is like the standard command that you use to cut execution of a program in the middle of it.
Yeah, that's been a common question, that if you happen to have an infinite loop in one of your programs, just use control C in order to break out of that infinite loop and be able to accomplish other things at your terminal. So rm-f, and in fact, taking that a step further, remember before how I had that really annoying time when I wanted to remove the foo directory? I want to just completely obliterate everything that's inside of it, and rmdir failed. Rmdir we basically never use, because the more common approach is rm-rf foo, which says recursively descend into this directory, which we'll talk a lot more about recursion in weeks to come. But basically, like, descend into this directory and just remove everything, keep descending, remove everything that you can possibly reach from this directory. So rm-rf foo will automatically go through, remove baz, remove bar, remove foo, and I don't have to deal with rmdir. So I literally never use rmdir. That said, you have to be very careful with rm-rf, because, this went down a bit. I probably did that at some point. So you have to be very careful with rm-rf foo, because imagine I add this same setup, bar baz, and then I tried to do something like rm-rf home directory slash foo, which theoretically this is, well, slash workspace slash foo. Theoretically this is fine, but what if I accidentally did something like this and hit enter? This would now remove my entire home directory, including all of the things within it. So if I had like my pset1, pset2, pset3 directories in my home directory, those are gone. So you have to be very careful with rm-rf, but to be honest, I use it all the time. Yeah?
If you were to do that accidentally, can you undo bash commands?
So there is no undo of bash commands. There have been times where people have accidentally rm-rf'd stuff, and basically this is a random command you'll never really need to use, but strings will return basically all of the things that can be interpreted as strings from a file. And so what I've had to do for people is run strings on their hard drive to try to look for a file that got deleted, because like the hard drive still has the contents of that file, they've just lost access to it.
Tune in for pset 4.
Yeah, that's a very pset 4 topic. Yeah, they're stored on Cloud9's hard drive.
Oh, okay.
But you could imagine it's stored on a hard drive that you have access to on Cloud9.
Okay.
All right. Other questions at this point? Yeah?
How do you cd into a directory that has spaces in the file name?
So if your directory has spaces in the file name, which generally just avoid that, but let's say I create a directory with a space in the file name, one way. First, it's going to be difficult for me to even create that directory. But one way of doing that is by using quotes. So quotes in bash will let me have something with a space in the name. So I could have a directory called Hello World. And notice that was created up here. And now an alternative way would have been hello backslash space world 2. Which the backslash is generally just a way of escaping characters. And when I say escaping characters, it's like, it's a way of signifying that I want this space to actually be included in this string and not to be treated as a normal space at the command line.
Similar to the way that we do backslash n in C in a string for a new line, it's not an n.
Because if I just did make dir hello world 2, it would create the directory hello and create the directory world 2. But this says, don't treat it as a space between, treat it as a literal space character in the full directory name. And so that's how you could end up removing them. You can say rmdir hello world or rmdir hello world 2. Any other questions? Yeah?
What if you actually wanted to print backslash n?
So if you actually want to print backslash n, then up here, I forgot to delete that. Up here, you could say backslash backslash n. And so similar to how backslash n is escaping an n to say I want a new line, backslash backslash escapes a backslash to say I want a literal backslash. So there are a whole bunch of different escape sequences like backslash t, backslash r, backslash b, and backslash backslash just happens to be another one. Anything else? Okay. So then to go into some more, I'll actually save this again so I have it. To go into a few more useful bash tricks, make hello. So if I say dot slash hello and then this greater than symbol and let's call it foo. So notice that this just created a file called foo. And now if I open that file, it has the contents hello world. So when I ran dot slash hello or greater than foo, notice that the hello world was not printed at the terminal, at the console. Instead, what this did was redirected the output of this program into this file called foo. Now we can do the opposite. So let's say hello world happened to and get an integer, and then print it.
As usual.
Yeah. Integer percent i n. And now that I did this, I have to make sure I include cs50.h, because I'm now getting an integer, which is in the cs50 library. OK? So now with this, if I just run this regularly, make hello, dot slash hello, hello world. Now it's waiting for me to enter an integer, 5. The integer was 5. OK, so what if I didn't want to have to type that at the command line? Well, I could create a file. Let's just reuse foo. So let's change the contents of foo to have the number 123 in it. So now I could run hello as .hello less than. So notice that up here it was greater than to pipe it into the file foo. Now with less than, I'm going to read from the file foo. So this said hello world. Now notice it didn't prompt me for an integer. Instead, it just read that integer from this file and printed out 1, 2, 3. Yeah?
When you pipe in, will it append or will it replace?
So you're saying if I go back out to foo?
Yeah, let's say you.
So if I do .hello into foo,
yeah,
it's now going to ask me for an integer, but I don't see that it's asking me for an integer because, so if I say 4, 5, 6, all of this, these are now the contents of foo.
Okay, so
and it, it, notice if I run it again, 100, it overwrites it. Okay. So the file is blown away. If you want to happen to append, you can use this double greater than. I almost never use that. But this, now if I say 3, 2, 1, notice these were actually appended to the file instead of overwriting it. That's common for like log files and stuff. Like if you have a file that's supposed to keep track of a bunch of errors, generally you want to append to it, not just blow it away. Yeah. So if this now int y equals get int, and I print both of them, so make hello dot slash hello 1, 2, so the integers were 1 and 2. So now in my file foo, if I had the integers 4, 3, 2, 5, 6, 7, so just separate lines, dot slash hello, pipe from foo, and it reads from that file those two. So similar to at the command line, how running the hello program, I would usually type 4, 3, 2, enter 5, 6, 7. That's literally the contents of this file. It's a 4, 3, 2, enter 5, 6, 7, and there's an implicit new line at the end of the file.
When you piped it into the example I just asked about, why didn't it prompt you, like why didn't it say integer? In your program, does it say?
I'm not currently prompting for that integer. If I wanted, so I actually could do integer, and then let's see what that ends up looking like. Make hello, dot slash hello, foo. So world, hello world, integer colon, integer colon, integer colon, 4, 3, 2, 5, 6, 7. Because these integer colons, normally if I ran it regularly, it would prompt me for the integer 5, prompt me for the integer 6, integer 5, 6. But here it's not prompting me because it's just reading from that file. But the prompts themselves are still printed. Okay, questions? Okay, so now similar to the program we saw before, echo, I'll just use that as an example. If I do echo one, the output would just be one. So I can say echo one, output to bar, and now the file bar will have the value one. So notice I could do something like, let's change hello to just take one integer again. So,
get rid of the percent I.
Now hello just takes one integer again. If I make hello, dot just hello, 5, integer 5. Okay, so echo 1000 and I output to a file bar, and I can run dot slash hello and read from that file bar, and it'll say 1000. So bar here was like a temporary file, basically, where I ran a program. In this case, it was a very trivial program, echo, that just echoed this value. But I ran this program echo. It echoed 1000, put it into this file bar. Then I immediately read from that file bar and put its contents into the program hello. So a shortcut for this, I could say echo 1000 pipe dot slash hello. So if I do this, it's the same exact thing. So this basically gets around the need for this temporary file. And now instead of needing to go dot slash hello and write the integer 1, 2, 3, and it'll print the integer 1, 2, 3, what this is saying is echo 1, 2, 3, take the standard out of take what's being printed to the console of that program and feed it into what the program after the pipe expects. So dot slash hello will be reading the output of echo 123, which happens to be 123. And we get that. So this you will potentially use in some cases with help 50. So you can run help 50 by just saying like help 50 make hello. But another way you could run help 50 is if you make hello and there's some error. So let's introduce an error. So make hello, it has an error. So notice that this was just output at the screen. So technically, well, okay, so if I make hello, I could theoretically store the contents of this output into a file called foo. So what went wrong is that technically there are two different types of output at the console. There is standard out and standard error. And it's just a way of easily differentiating between messages that are supposed to be normal for the program and messages that are errors. And so an easy way of piping instead both standard out and standard error is with this ampersand. And so all output of this file will now go into, or of this program will now go into foo. So now there was nothing, and I can look at the file foo, and its contents are that error message. So I can do the same thing with a pipe, where if I do make hello and I get an error message, I can pipe that into help 50. And OK, David told me to do this. Let's try that version. OK, that version was fine. So in this case, the ampersand happens to have to go on the other side of the pipe. But this is equivalent to if I had run help 50 make hello. So here we have that output, which matches this output. So we'll see eprintf in a bit. But basically, eprintf, you've seen printf so far, which prints to standard out. Eprintf will print to standard error. Without touching anything else, they both just appear at the terminal, at the console. And so you can't really tell the difference. But when you start dealing with piping things, you can differentiate between standard out and standard error. So it's literally, well, the default standard out is this. It's what's on the screen, what gets printed to. So like instead, you could write into a file, but that's not standard out. Standard out, the default is this. And then standard out, you can manipulate using things like this, this, and this. This one technically manipulates standard in. This one, which standard in is just your keyboard. This one manipulates both standard out and standard in. It manipulates the standard out of the program on the left and puts it into the standard in of the program on the right. And this is takes the standard out of a program and puts it into a file. Okay. And last but not least, just to mention it, you have access to reference 50, which should be mentioned in the problem set specs. But if you look at reference 50, what most of those pages are taken from, and then ultimately we try to simplify some of them for the less comfy versions on reference 50. But basically, if there's ever a program you don't know, instead of looking it up on reference 50, you can instead use the man command to look up something. So if I say man ls, so I'm going to want a lot more space for this. But man ls tells me ls is a program that lists directory contents. And so I can scroll down and see, oh, these are the flags that ls takes. So ls-a is a flag that ls takes that tells it, do not ignore entries starting with dot, which is what we saw before. ls-a just shows all of the files, including hidden files. And there's a whole bunch of different flags that ls can take. Not only can you use programs and commands like that, but you can also use functions. So we can say man printf. And this gives us the man, well, printf's a bad example. Man round. That's also probably going to be a bad example.
Yeah.
Okay, no, round is good. So round is a function that if you were at the walkthrough today, and if you look at the pset for greedy, the round function is required to round a floating point value to an integer value. And so if you didn't know how to use round, I could say man round, and it gives me this output that says, okay, to use round, I need to hash include math.h. Good to know. And here happens to be the signature for round, which you'll get a lot more into signatures in a bit. It also tells us we'll need to link with -lm, which says we need to include the math library, and we'll talk more about linking when we get to the compiling process. Yeah?
Could you look up commands in cs50.h?
So you cannot look up commands in cs50.h because we did not create man pages for them. I am almost positive. Yeah, we should. But they do not exist. Basically, there's a directory in the file system that has these pages that like describe how all of the programs work, and we didn't write such manual pages for the CS50 functions. Other questions? Okay, we'll pass it over to you.
All right.
Hopefully, things will go smoothly.
Question. For just like P sets, when you turn them in and they're let's say you pass all the tests, does that necessarily mean you're gonna get like a 100% on the assignment or like get a good grade on the assignment, or does that just mean you're like passing specific tests?
So for Check 50 purposes, if you pass Check 50, then you generally know you're going to do well on correctness. But each assignment is graded on scope, correctness, design, and style. So design and style specifically, we go in and look at your code to make sure it's done efficiently, to make sure that your variable names are good, to make sure that your indentation is good. So we check those things manually, which those things won't be caught by Check 50. But if you pass all of Check 50, it's still possible there's some bug that you have that will happen to notice. But generally, if you pass Check 50, your correctness score is solid. And correctness is the most important criteria. Yeah?
Will we receive your evaluation? So for example, if I make a very inefficient but correct code, will I get to know that?
Yes, your TF will let you know. Your TF will comment on your problem sets, letting you know design and style issues.
That's our primary purpose in grading.
Yeah.
When you say style issues, does that mean there are certain styles that your decision model? Like, for example, putting the first curly brace not on the same line. Because like, I've noticed the professor, he like puts on the next line.
But... Okay, I no longer have it plugged in. But basically, if you put, I know, if you happen to choose a different style. So for example, if you happen to put the curly brace on the same line as a for loop and a while loop, that's totally fine. Basically, you just have to be self-consistent. If you start putting the curly brace on the same line in some places and putting it on the next line in other places, that's not good.
That said, there are some stylistic choices that are always bad. Like if you name all of your variable names single letters, or did Doug say he had a student or something who just named them all like Norse gods? Like, that's fun, but it doesn't tell you anything about what's going on in the variables.
Yeah.
So that will, like, even if you're consistent about your mythological name scheme, that's not going to get you a good style grade.
Also, what did we find out exactly about like our TFs and our sections? Like, how does the actual class in that respect work? Like, when are we, I know we don't have to necessarily go to lecture,
Sectioning will happen this weekend, yeah. And you'll find out your TFs then.
Yeah.
Okay, and then you'll find out, like, how many sections a week is it?
It's one.
One section a week.
Yep. Yeah. All right, any other logistical questions?
If we go to office hours, will the people helping us look at style and stuff like that and help us with that type of thing?
You can
at office hours.
Questions.
Yeah, you can ask questions about style and design at office hours, but don't expect the TF to give you the correct design and style answers. Like, yeah, that there was a couple years back that a student came up to me and is like, all right, I have a question. Okay. And he goes through his entire program. He's like, okay, so here I'm getting an integer. Here I'm looping. Here I'm nested for loop. Here I'm printing it out. Okay. And then he's like, all right, what? He's like, does it look good? Do you not have like a specific question for me? Did you just want to read me your code and let me tell you if he's like, yeah, are there any like design flaws? I'm not going to tell you that. Like you should think through the code. If you happen to say like, this doesn't seem like it could, this seems like it could be done better, I might be able to like direct you in the right direction, but the TF isn't going to tell you the best way to do something.
So you could say like, does this loop look efficient or should I try to Like, I want to make sure I do it right, but I don't really necessarily know what's right.
So generally, no. The TF will not tell you that the loop is as efficient as possible. Though they might tell you something like, maybe there's a better way. They won't tell you any sorts of answers in that direction, but they can generally let you know that sort of like that there might be, so that like they don't want you to give up trying to find a better design if there happens to be one. But they won't tell you what it is. Other questions? All right.
Yeah.
Oh. A bunch of like random print statements and everything just kind of there that I used for my own personal debugging. Should I delete those before submitting the code?
Yeah, so if you have random printf statements in your code, you need to pass check 50. Otherwise, your TF will be mad at you. Because that's what we use for grading correctness, is check 50. So if you have random printfs, generally you will not pass check 50.
Because
that's fine. For the most part, you should probably delete the commented out printfs unless they're like very sensible, but in any programs in this course, they probably won't be sensible. So you probably should just delete all your printfs that are extraneous.
So that, and that wouldn't be a design problem. That would just be a style issue in that you have commented code sitting around. It doesn't affect how your program runs, but it makes it harder to read through. That's where that would end up. All right. Now, any more?
Should we annotate everything with comments?
For some definition of everything. So commenting is a little bit of an art in that there is, you can definitely do too little commenting. You can also do too much. To start off with, you should probably err on the side of too much, and your TF can give you feedback to say, okay, so here's actually maybe something you didn't need to tell me. Your TF can read C code. You don't need to say, here, I'm printing out this variable. We can read that. But higher level things about how does this block of code work? What is its purpose? Those are useful. And yes, if you don't have comments, you will get a bad style grade. Yep. All right.
What else gives you bad grades?
Bad code. Don't write it. As software developers, we never write bad code.
Yeah.
And like, if it says num of teams, for example, there with like underscores, can you do instead of like capitalization for each new word?
So num of teams. Notice that we have underscores to separate the words. A very common alternative is to have camel case. So like, num capital O F capital T E A M. Generally in C, the preference tends to be towards underscores. That's not strictly true. In CS50, we'll generally do underscores. So like, notice like get int is get underscore int. We actually changed that for this year. So get underscore int. So like, if you want to be consistent with everything else, do underscores. But if you make all of your code have camel case or something, that's fine.
All right, so we'll try to move pretty quickly through this. I think hopefully a fair number of you have taken, have some experience in Java or maybe in C or something like Python. So these concepts will be a little bit of review. If not, that's okay. There are a lot of resources available, including the less comfortable lecture from earlier, the super section from earlier. So variables in C are relatively similar to variables in Java or those other languages. They all have a type and they have a name. To declare variables, it's as such, you've seen this in lecture before, you can declare multiple variables on the same line, such as float XYZ or in score number of teams. In this case, X, Y, and Z will all be floats. You can also, in one line, initialize variables, give them actual values. You can do that for multiple variables on the same line. That said, that's also probably not great style. You can do it, but often it's a good habit to give a description to your variables, and it's very hard to do that if they're on the same line. So splitting things up will never really be a bad decision, or very rarely, I'd say. Just have meaningful variable names, as we talked about.
Norse gods are not a great option. Try to describe what's going on. So on the previous slide, there's a name like score or number of teams. And as we were saying, for style, as long as you're consistent, that's great. For loops, that's a special case. You may be familiar with like a structure of for int I equals 0, I less than n, I plus plus. So I is a single letter variable there. But because that's convention, that's something that other people can still read very easily. Don't worry about single letter variable names there. Also, be consistent with your initialization if you are doing things on the same line. So this example here, quarters is initial is declared, dimes is initialized. Spread those out into two lines so that there aren't sort of conflicts there. All right? Any questions about variables? Good. Okay. So loops. The next thing, we've used loops for Scratch. You had to use a loop for Scratch. There were a few different types, repeating things for a certain number of steps, repeating something until something happened, repeating something forever. We have also a few different types of loops in C. I know that there are three of each. Those are not, it's not like a one-to-one correlation there. For loops and while loops and do while loops can really all be used to do those things on the left that Scratch can do. But the first one we'll look at is a for loop. This is the general structure. Yeah, the keyword for, and then there are three parts within the parentheses. The first one being the initialization of some variable. Classically, that's like int I equals 0, but it can be a number of different things. Some condition, which is that when that condition is no longer true, we'll break out of this loop, or we won't go back into it again. An update, which generally takes the variable that we set in the initialization and does something to it. If it's an integer, maybe it would increase it or decrease it. And as per the diagram, every time we go through the loop, we check the condition. If it's true, we go through the loop another time. If it's false, we exit without executing that code. So as a standard example, this code would print, this is CS50, 10 times on 10 different lines. Relatively straightforward, and we've seen that before. This code will also, I believe, be available online along with this film, the video of the super section. So don't feel like you need to copy all of it down. Meanwhile, while loops they have a similar purpose. You can code a while loop with a for loop, and you can code a for loop with a while loop. It's just a slightly different structure that may make it more convenient to do certain things with. And as you can see, it's a slightly less complicated syntax. We just say, while some condition is true, loop through this code. So we start out, we check whether the condition is true. If it is, we execute the code in the body of the loop. We go back to the top, we check the condition. If it's true, execute again. We continue that pattern. If it's false, we exit the loop. One thing that confused me for a while when I started out was if something changes within the while loop that makes the condition no longer true, you do not break out immediately. I don't know why I had that misconception, but I did. So you could have a Boolean value, so a true or false, that would say, be initially set to true. You could say, while this Boolean value is true, execute code. And then within the value, this is a tangent. We can look at an example for this. Actually, this is not super helpful. So this is analogous to Scratch's forever loop. If we're looking at the condition there, the condition is simply true. That statement will always be true. So any code that is in the body of the while loop will run over and over and over again. So in this example, this line will print an infinite number of times. Finally, the third type of loop is a do while loop. This is especially useful for like input validation. If you're asking users to give you some value and you want to check whether it falls under some bounds or not, So like this might be very helpful for the problem set this week. So you when your code reaches a do while loop, it will execute the code within the loop, and only after executing that code once will it check the condition. So you're guaranteed to have whatever's, you know, whatever's in red there go through once, and then and only then, if the condition is false, you won't do it again. So in this example, this is an example of input validation. So you might ask a user for a positive integer. So if we do that, we ask and we use getInt, which again is from the CS50 library, and say the user gives us -2. It gets put into input, and then we hit the while condition. Clearly, -2 is less than 1, so the condition is true, and we go back to the top of the execute loop. Again, we print out enter a positive integer. Maybe we print 5 this time. Input is set equal to 5. We hit the condition. 5 is not less than 1, so we break out of the loop, and input is now permanently set equal to 5. Are we clear on loops?
Yeah, so basically, there with any given loop, you can create the other two loops. So like with you, the language could exist with just a for loop, because you can accomplish while loops and do while loops with just for loops. And with do while loops, you can accomplish for loops and while loops. So basically, they're all just different forms to implement looping that you use in different scenarios. For do while loops, pretty much they are very rare. User input is one of the few scenarios where do while loops are what you want to use. And even then, I tend to not use do while loops for user input, because usually I want the print message to be different. Usually I want, like, please enter an integer, then get the integer, and then a while loop that says, while it's invalid, that wasn't a good integer, please try again. But with a do while loop, like, you can't change that message. So even then, do while loops are, like, limited. So do while loops are rare. Rarely think of them as the correct option. Yeah?
Would that just keep printing that on the same line?
Yes.
So you do you mean, so this will do enter a positive integer, and then if I said -3 and I hit enter, that enter goes to the new line. So like the physical enter key that is typed is a new line character.
I'm in extend mode, so I can't do anything. I actually have an example for that, so we can just see it. So if we run this, the reason that my cursor is on the same line is because there was no new line there. I put in a number, and then I'm going to hit enter, which will bring it down to a new line. But yeah, in the case of people inputting things, often it's convenient to have it be on the same line. Okay. Next topic, conditionals. You're going to be using these a lot, just to describe the flow of your program. We have a few different options. The top three are what you'll be using most of the time, and they all go together. An if statement is the most straightforward of these. If some condition is true, then execute the code in between in its block. So in the case of this program, which is something that a very basic program, we put in an integer, and then based on what that integer is, we print out a certain message. If n is greater than 0, then we can recognize that as a positive number and print out a message accordingly. Now, if we wanted to also pick out negative numbers, we could add another condition saying if n is less than 0, print f, you picked a positive number. And that would work fine, but it's actually slightly more efficient to put this into an else if. So using else if with an if chains the two blocks together, because in this case, say that a user put in a positive number. Say the user put in 5. We would run through the first if case. We would say, yes, n is greater than 0. We would print, you picked a positive number. And because these two things are linked together with this else keyword. We don't need to check if 5 is less than 0. Whereas if we had if n is greater than 0, print positive. If n is less than 0, print negative. We would have to check both times, which is just slightly less efficient. We also then can finish this off with else. So this is sort of our default case. If we don't match anything in the first if statement, and if we don't match anything in the second else if statement, we'll do the thing that we've specified in the block for the third else. Let's see, and just an example of, again, efficiency. This is a valid way to, say, print out somebody's letter grade based on their numerical grade. But in this case, we have to run through 5 different if checks to figure out exactly what should be printed out. Meanwhile, so in the case that, say, they got an A, they got a 95, we hit the first one, we get true in the condition, we print it out, and then we still have to check all 4 others. Meanwhile, if we switch it over to else ifs and a final else, that's not the case. We check the first case, and then we can exit the entire structure. Yes?
Okay. So for ifs and else ifs, if there's only one line, do we need the curly brackets?
You don't need curly brackets for C to compile properly. That said,
I've gone back and forth on it over the years. Style 50 will demand that you put the curly braces. At this point, I tend to put the curly braces rather than not, just because like it makes it easier if I want to happen to add a printf statement in there for debugging purposes. Then I don't, if it's a single line and I need to add a printf, then I need to add the curly braces too. And like, I don't know, it's just at this point, I just always put the curly braces.
Yeah, personally, when I'm reading somebody's code,
it's like when I see a struct, you know, a single line if statement without the curly braces, it takes me a second to process what exactly is going on because I don't see it that often. So I definitely prefer to even have them in the single case just because it's consistent with all the other if statements that you see.
It also tends to lead to bugs where if you have a single line and then you happen to add a second line to the if and you don't remember to add the curly braces, all of a sudden that second line is actually being always executed rather than only under that condition.
Yep.
Are single line if statements fine if they're like really simple?
It's the same, the question being if our
stylistically.
Yeah. So that's essentially what we're saying.
You won't get penalized, but at this point, I generally avoid single line, leaving out the curly braces for single line ifs.
I would, even if it's very simple, I would still rather see the braces.
It happens to be more egregious with CS50 style that like the curly braces are on their own lines.
Yeah.
But like if curly brace line and curly brace else curly brace line and curly brace, it's not that bad. Like it only increases by like a single curly brace.
Okay. Switch statements are another way to handle sort of Boolean flows. It's something that we probably don't use very often because the cases in which you can use it are fairly limited. But here, in this case, it's checking inputs. We use switch is the keyword, and then you have some variable that is input. In this case, I've literally called it input, but that could be a variable name, it could be n, it could be a Norse god, if that's your thing. And then it's checked against the various cases. So if this input as an integer is equal to 1, that case, we'll get to that case, or we will be brought to that case and print out your output is a 1. If negative 12 is input, we'll print out that line. If we don't have, if say we put in a 3, that case is not on there, which is why there's a default statement. So in the case that if something isn't recognized, the default is the code that we'll execute. Switches are slightly more efficient than using an if-else, but in today's world of fast computers, it doesn't matter a lot. And ifs might be easier to read.
Yeah, if you take CS61, you'll learn more about it. But basically, like if input is negative 12, we can jump immediately to the compiler will create this thing called a jump table, where we can jump immediately to case negative 12, unlike an if, else, if, else, if, where we'd have to say, if input equals equals 0, well, it doesn't. If input equals equals 1, well, it doesn't. If input equals equals 5, it doesn't. If input equals equals negative 12, oh, it does. Let me execute this. With the switch statement, it can jump immediately to case negative 12. But again, like back when C was first made, that was a relevant speed difference, and now it kind of isn't. Yeah.
Is there a similar function in Java?
I'm pretty sure switch case exists in Java. A limitation of switch in C is that it can only be integer value types. So we couldn't switch on a float. We couldn't switch on a string. Right. Other languages allow for that, but other languages don't have that efficiency boost where, like, if you were allowed to switch on a string, it couldn't jump immediately to the correct string.
All right. And then a final Boolean topic is the ternary operator. This is a fairly common structure that you might put together in your code, where based on some outside value, you want to set your string or your integer or whatever equal to one value or another. So that's by CS50 styles parameters, by style 50, that's 9 lines of code, looking at starting from string and going to the second set of curly braces. That can all be combined into one line in a way that is considered stylistically good. So this is just a construct that sort of syntactic sugar that C has built in along with a lot of other languages. And it's pretty painful, once you get used to it, it's pretty painful to look at the expanded version. Compared to this single line option. So that the syntax is using the question mark and the colon.
Yeah, the reason it's called ternary operator is because it has three arguments to it. So like plus is a binary operator. 2 plus 3, the two arguments are 2 and 3. Here we have three arguments. You have that condition, then you have if that condition is true, the first possibility, and if that condition is false, the second possibility. So the way I like to read it, I read the colon as else, and the question mark is literally a question. So like, n greater than 100, high, else low.
So in our code, you want us to write it the first style?
If you write it in your code the first way, it's fine. If you write it in the second way, that's great. Yes, you should make an effort to use ternary where possible. No, that's not to say if you get ridiculous, like.
Is this like all it applies to, or does it apply to literally everything?
It applies to some scenarios where, like, I don't know, there are cases where consider a printf where I want to, you enter an integer, and that integer is, I don't know, the number of minutes. So you want to print, like, X minutes. But if it happens to be a 1 that's entered, you want to print 1 minutes without the S. Yeah. So in that case, I might use in the printf, I might have something that's one of the arguments is number greater than 1, then S, else empty string. That's just another random scenario where I might happen to use it. But you can use it anywhere this sort of like this structure is expected.
Is there like a style guide online?
The ternary operator probably doesn't fit in style 50.
Yeah.
Because it's, but there are cases where people try to nest ternary operators. I recommend against that. Yeah.
For the switch, does it have to equal, does it have to be an equality, or can you have like greater than or less than?
So for switch, it has to be an equality. And that goes back to the fact that it creates this jump table. And so if you wanted, you could say case 1 colon, case 2 colon, case 3 colon, case 4 colon, and then have the line that you want to happen.
Everything 1, 2, 3, 4,
yes. But you cannot say case n less than 1 greater than whatever.
Okay, we'll quickly look at the numeric data types and see this is not a chart that you need to have memorized. This is not a chart that you need to write down. You can look most of these values up. That said, it is a good idea to know the number of bytes in these various data types. And just a quick thing, I say that integers are 4 bytes on the IDE. Because we're working on a 64-bit architecture there. There are computers in which that's not the case, but for our purposes, an integer is 4 bytes.
Basically, for all of these data types, the only data type that has a defined value is char, which is 1 byte. The rest of them are all defined relative to one another. So like a short happens to be 2 bytes in almost all scenarios, but the only thing the C standard says is that a short is greater than or equal to a char. And an int is greater than or equal to a short. And a long is greater than or equal to an int. And a long long is greater than or equal to a long. So technically, they could all be 1 byte and they'd satisfy the C standard. But they tend to be 1 byte for char, 2 byte for short, 4 byte for int, 4 to 8 bytes for long, and 8 bytes for long long.
Yeah. So looking more specifically at floats, because imprecision is an important topic, something that comes up in the P set. The example that we saw in lecture 1 divided by 10, which we know as exactly 0.1, is not the case in this representation. It's similar to the way that we as humans in decimal can't easily store 1/3. We don't have enough places. We don't have an infinite number of places to keep putting 3s in. Similarly, in this binary representation, 0.1 doesn't fit nicely. So that's as close as a float can get.
Yeah, so this isn't 100% what it's like, but you know how in binary we have, like, without thinking about decimals yet, we have access to 2 to the 0, 2 to the 1, 2 to the 2. So we have access to like 4, 2, 1, and any power of 2. Well, it works the same way with decimals, that we basically have access to 2 to the negative 1, 2 to the negative 2, 2 to the negative 3. So if we have access to 0.5, 0.25, and negative 0.12, and 0.125, we have access to like a finite number of those fractions. And so if we want to represent 0.1, then kind of the closest we can get is 0.125. If we give ourselves more bits, then we can try like adding some things, but it's difficult to represent exactly 0.1 when we only have these powers of 2, these fractional powers of 2.
And I'm going to ignore the second half of this slide for now because it's not something that you need to know for the course. It's just interesting stuff, and we don't have that much time, but I'd be happy to talk about it later with people if you're interested. Additionally, that's the same table as before. Characters, also something we've talked about, so 1 byte, and they are literally treated as integers. So you can add them as integers, and printing out here, %d, I think we generally use %i for CS50, that's my mistake on this, but those will both function to print out an integer. So in that case, we will literally print 66. If instead we decide that we're using %c to print out a character, it can take an integer and print that letter out. So in that case, A. But it's, I mean, you do math with letters. That's PSET 2. You'll do a lot of that.
%d, the D stands for decimal. If you are ever going to look up an example, you're more likely to see D than I. We just happen to use I in the course because you're printing an integer, so I is more intuitive. There's very subtle differences that it doesn't really matter. Yeah.
Could you repeat briefly why it's 66 versus I? Why it prints?
Yes, yes. So, okay, so to start off with, so I'm just going to say capital A, that character is represented by the integer 65. So when we say the character A plus 1, that's equal to 66. That line will print out as an integer because I use %d there, which specifies that we're printing out an integer value. So that's how the computer reads it. In the other case, we're saying 65, which again is equivalent to the letter capital A, plus small a, minus capital A. By standard arithmetic rules, that leaves us with little a. That will be printed out as a character because of the percent C.
So it's the percent, okay.
Yes. Yep. I think we're also going to skip 2's complement. That's another topic that's outside of the scope of what you really need to know, but is an interesting thing.
If you're at the walkthrough today, this is what we started talking about, but you kind of glossed over.
It's how the way that we store negative numbers for integers, which is pretty fascinating, and the people who made it were smart. But yeah, so Rob's going to, I think, finish it off talking about compilation stuff briefly. Yeah.
So he started talking about compilation stuff at the end of the lecture, the film's lecture. And so let's go through all of the steps of compilation. So we saw in the lecture that there are basically 4 steps. There's pre-processing. There's compilation. There's assembling. And there is linking. So don't get confused. Is it not working?
Yeah.
Can I just use yours?
Yes.
Do you have your IDE open?
Yep.
So don't get confused about the fact that within the compilation process, there is a step called compilation. We'll see the difference in a second. So let's create, it's so small. Do you have a zoom shortcut?
Nope.
Darn it. let's try if I can get this with this guy. So let's just start with the simple Hello World program. Now, if you remember from lecture, the first step, pre-processing, handles these hash directives that we see. Basically, in this course, you'll mostly just see hash include and soon hash defines. But the preprocessor handles these steps. And so to see what that looks like, if I were to run on my hello.c file, if instead of just running clang hello.c, I run clang-e hello.c with a capital E, boom. Well, you can't really tell, but let me scroll. Let's do this, because this file won't change, basically. But let's scroll up. We see all of this output. So I could, if I wanted, store that in a separate file, hello temp.c. Let's take a look at that file. Notice how I used the pipe out to store in a file, hello temp.c. So what does this file look like? It's got all this stuff at the top. And if I go all the way down to the bottom, I see my int main printf hello world. So basically, the preprocessor took this hash include standard.io.h, took the contents of standard.io.h, and roughly pasted it into the top of my hello.c file. And we can see, if I do a search, that somewhere in here, it's difficult to parse what this is supposed to be, but somewhere in here I see that it's declaring this printf function, and so this is why we needed to include standard.io.h. We needed access to this line that told the program how printf works. And so similarly, when we hash include cs50.h, it does this copy and paste of the cs50.h contents at the top of the file, so it knows how getInt and getString work. Okay, so that's the first step, pre-processing, just does that. The second step, we can see if I do clang dash s hello.c, and this will create a file hello.s. This is the one that David showed in lecture, that this has assembly code. So this is the compilation step, which it took a higher level language like C and compiled it down into a lower level language, assembly code, and that is generally the term for compilation. Like, taking a language and transforming it into another language is compilation. So we could have a compiler that takes JavaScript code and compiles it into C code, and then you could have a compiler that compiles that C code into assembly. So you don't need to understand this, but if you take CS61, you'll get a taste of what all this means. The next step is assembly. So clang dat.
I don't know.
I'll skip that. So clang dash C hello.c will do everything up to the assembling step. Now notice that I have a hello.o file. What happens if I try to open hello.o? Can't open it. File format unsupported. Well, I can try to forcibly open it at the terminal just to see. And we see a bunch of garbage. So this is basically one step away from that fully executable file. This is the same garbage that we saw if we tried to open the executable file. The thing that's missing is this linking step, where basically there are other functions that we need to include in this executable file to get things going. So for example, roughly, printf is an example of a function that we were using printf, but when we compiled hello.o, we don't have the printf function included in hello.o. So when I do a full compilation, if I do make hello, it'll do the full compilation into the executable hello, and I look at the size difference, the hello executable is 8,600 bytes, whereas hello.o, which included everything but linking, was 1,500 bytes. So the size of the file grew substantially because it needed to include all of these other functions to end up with a fully executable file. Now, the slight trick here is technically there is both static linking and dynamic linking, where static linking is including a whole bunch of functions into this actual executable. But printf is an example of dynamic linking that we only look up the printf code when we run .hello. So you don't have to worry about that. You'll learn more about it in CS61. But basically, the growth in the hello file is because it needs to include a whole bunch of stubs to look up where printf is actually located. It needs stubs to actually like call main when you're supposed to run the program. So like, you know how we, whenever you run a program, the first thing that happens is we jump to main. Well, the reason that is because when we fully compile the program, it gets set up to start running at main. We have a function that ultimately calls main. Questions? Yeah.
So compilation takes C to assembly code, and assembling takes assembly code to machine code?
Yeah, so the assembling is not considered a compilation step because basically it's a one-to-one mapping from an assembly instruction to the binary that the machine needs to understand the program. So if you gave me a binary and a table, it would take me a while, but I could ultimately use that table to translate that binary into assembly. It would be much harder to transfer that assembly into C because compilation is a much more complex step. Other questions? All right. Oh.
Why doesn't it go straight from C to machine code? Why does it in between steps?
So if I type just make hello, it will compile it fully, but ultimately is still doing these steps. Like, it's broken up into these steps only because like that is a natural flow for how to get this thing compiled. Like we had from the beginning of Intel processors, we had an assembly language. So there's no reason to go directly from C to binary when we have this intermediate assembly language that already has an assembler. So we just need to get from C to assembly. And then if I create a higher level language like Java or something, Java's a bad example,
JavaScript.
But JavaScript, I don't know. We could compile JavaScript to C. We don't need to come up with a JavaScript to assembly compiler because as long as we can get it to C, we already have something that can compile C. Yeah?
So Clang actually goes through like, I don't know, LLVM or something?
Yeah. Clang. LLVM, if you hear the term, is sort of the back end to Clang. LLVM, in the past, there are basically two main C compilers, GCC and Clang. So if you're ever doing any Googling and you see GCC, you can basically replace GCC with Clang. So Clang is a front end to the LLVM compiler, which is like new on the scene, but it is very user friendly and very very easy to use in your own programs to like adapt to LLVM, whereas GCC is just a monster of a program. All right, nice. Good luck in the problem set.